anything we should not talk about? I don't know if there's like secret stuff we need to avoid or
I don't think there are any.
By which I mean, please reveal the secrets so I cannot reveal them.
Right. If you could please list the things that we can't talk about in detail.
Hello and welcome to The Dirt. I'm Mark Grambo, and I'm here today with Steve Hickey.
Hey, Mark. What's up?
Oh, not too much. How are you doing?
Good. Good, good, good.
Well, we started last week an awesome new series on designing for the future on an episode talking about fictional UI, designing for fake spacecraft and outer space in the world of the Avengers and science fiction. We want to talk about really what it is really like to design for outer space, and we have an expert on the subject. We'd like to welcome Jesse Chris, Senior Design Lead at NASA JPL's Human Interfaces Group. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So for those uninitiated, Jesse, what is NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory?
So the Jet Propulsion Laboratory is a NASA center. It's actually operated by Caltech for NASA, and our specialty is in robotic space missions. So if you've seen anything about Curiosity or any of the earlier Mars rovers, that stuff largely happens here. You know, those are JPL missions supported by scientists all over the world.
So I know you can't see past my mic right now, but I have the biggest, dumbest, stupidest grin on my face. Just because we're talking to a design expert that helps explore the solar system with robots. I'm just, oh my God.
That's our job. Yep.
So we're really happy to have you on. I actually first discovered you, Jesse. I discovered you. That's right. I feel like I sound like a music producer.
Yeah.
I first stumbled upon you at I/O conference last year, 2014, where you gave, along with a colleague of yours at JPL, a really fantastic talk. It was called Parlor Tricks, Space Robots and the Future We Want. And the thing that has stuck with me, and I've retold the summary of this part of your talk a million times to people, so excited. You gave a presentation about how your team had used Oculus Rift to change how NASA's scientists were able to visualize Mars. Can you tell how you guys did that?
Sure. So one of the things our lab does here is we keep an eye on the latest consumer technology for 3D interfaces, whether they're screens or controllers or anything like that. We're at a really interesting moment now where the stuff that's coming off the shelf was science fiction, you know, 20 years ago, incredibly expensive and locked up in labs 10 years ago, and now you can go buy it at the store, basically. So we're at this really interesting moment where we can apply those technologies to space operations without enormous R&D costs. The R&D costs are now in figuring out how to use them appropriately and deciding what is appropriate. So for Mars rover operations, you know, the rovers are going around collecting imagery. A lot of that is actually already 3D imagery, but it's still primarily viewed on computer screens. Right? You browse through individual 2D images. You kind of piece together what that scene looks like in your head, and then you can start making decisions, or the science team can start making decisions about where they want to go next, what exactly they want to do at a given location. So we were looking at these two things and saying, you know what, we have a hunch that if people actually experience this in 3D as a 3D environment, they'll gain a much more accurate understanding, and they'll gain that understanding more quickly. So we put together a prototype with the Oculus Rift where we took real rover data and reconstructed Mars. And then we ran an experiment. We took people from the science team who are using these 2D tools every day as part of their job, and we said, here, try this in the Oculus Rift, and we've labeled a few points, and we want you to make an overhead map and tell us where you think those points are. So we had them do that with the Oculus Rift. We had them do it with their regular 2D tools, and the results were, frankly, astonishing. And we had a hunch that it would be better, but it was substantially better. Not only were they more accurate, but they were in much more close agreement with each other. So this means not only are they seeing something and understanding something more accurately, but they're able to talk about it with a group of scientists with a lot less confusion. So we really won on both fronts there. And so that, to us, was this really exciting first data-backed experiment that says, yes, this is working, and it's working on multiple fronts.
It's just an extraordinary experiment and story. I remember looking at those images you showed us in the audience as examples, and those 2D images, it's not like just a 2D image from your camera. It was a stitched panorama or a panoramic image, and it just made me think of super, super wide angle lenses that people use in like home photography for real estate to make a tiny, tiny kitchen look vast. And your brain goes, no, that looks a little weird and warped. And at such an extreme...
Well, not to mention the scale of natural objects in the landscape being so vastly different than it is here on Earth, and the relative lack of objects of which have a scale we can comprehend to do any sort of comparison with.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's an excellent point. That's actually a huge issue, is people trying to assess scale. Mm-hmm. One of the things we did with the Oculus, and that we're doing in upcoming tools, is we put the rover in the scene. Mm. And people know how big the rover is. They have a sense of that. So just that one scale reference helps a lot. Of course, if you can put in other objects like, you know, the height of a person, and you're walking around in it, now it's even better. And we've seen this over and over again as we're testing the newest project we're working on, that we just hear these exclamations of, oh, wow, I had no idea that was that size. You know, we were just debating of whether that was 2 meters tall or 8 meters tall, right? So scale is a huge issue here.
So you have to insert a variety of objects into the image to actually assess that?
So part of it is we think about how people work naturally on Earth, right? And you get the natural cues of being a person in that space. You get the cues of seeing other people in it. Mm-hmm. But often what geologists will do if they're taking pictures is they will put an object in the photo.
Okay.
Whether that's a, you know, a Swiss Army knife or a coin or something, or a ruler. So typically when you take something out of the environment, you do want some kind of scale indicator. Yeah.
Have you ever, when testing the scale with people, have you ever inserted like a bantha, one of those giant hairy things from Star Wars?
Man, I've been so tempted for whatever reason. When we were first talking about this, I was just thinking, oh, we should put a rubber duck in there. Like, yeah. It doesn't even make sense. They come in all sizes. That's a terrible thing. The temptation has been there. We haven't done anything quite like that yet.
Yeah, currency makes for a nice universal thing we can all understand. You talked about sort of the next phase of how to do this even better. Jesse, you shared on April 1st and very coyly wrote in your tweet, this is not an April Fool's joke, a job post for a new function at NASA JPL, a technical artist to, quote, build holographic interfaces for controlling spacecraft, which is...
So
out of this world and crazy.
Not to mention the fact that tweet was the entire motivation behind creating this series.
Yeah.
Like, I just remembered that offhand. Like, holy crap, we can do an episode about spaceships, and we can do an episode about science fiction.
Yes.
So we understand that NASA JPL has a collaboration with Microsoft's HoloLens team to take this idea of seeing the space around them more naturally to the next level. Can you talk a little bit about what that's going to be?
Sure. Yeah, so the experiments we were doing with the Oculus Rift really set the stage for this and showed that there was promise in this area. It was we are collaborating with Microsoft now. It was a very well-timed collaboration, thanks to the earlier work that we had done and obviously the earlier work that they had done. And so the HoloLens, in case people haven't heard about it, it's a self-contained holographic computing platform. So it has some things in common with Google Glass and Oculus Rift, but there are a few major differences. One is that it's pass-through augmented reality. So that is to say, it's about putting objects virtually into your world. It's not about putting you behind black plastic and putting you in a completely synthesized world. It's also completely self-contained. So you don't have to plug it into a computer. It is a computer, right? Mm-hmm. So what this allows us to do here at JPL is... we're now working on the capability that will allow Mars scientists to work on Mars together from their offices, essentially.
Man.
Oh, my God.
So the software we're building is called OnSite, and it brings in real Mars imagery from the Curiosity rover, and the Mars scientists will have these in their offices, the HoloLens. They'll be able to put it on, boot up our software, and the Mars terrain from the most current site drive will show up around them in their office. They can look around, walk around, you know, move around virtually in that environment, and they can actually work together in that space. If someone else calls into a session, that person's avatar shows up located physically where that person is standing virtually in the world. So you can see not only where people are standing, but you can see where they're looking, which is a huge thing. I mean, it's the equivalent of pointing.
Yeah.
And we lose that so often in our 2D screen-based interfaces.
Well, I've seen there's so many examples of that from science fiction and, you know, popular television and movies. And if it extends all the way from like this utopian vision of it working perfectly all the way down to people mocking it ceaselessly. And it just cracks me up that the first practical implementation of that happens to be on Mars.
Yeah.
Or that's the environment to be used. Like, that's so beyond anything I could have conceived of.
Well, it's great because it's this kind of extreme telepresence is meant to solve a problem that we don't have commonly in daily life here, you know.
Yeah, I guess the need for it is so much greater when you're studying something so far outside of your normal sphere of understanding.
Right. It's one thing to say, hey, we choose not to be working in the same place because we want to be a distributed company, so we need communication tools to help us, you know, mm-hmm. be able to take, you know, work from home. It's another thing to say, we literally physically cannot be in the same place. We cannot be on the planet that we are studying. Mm-hmm. So you have to get creative. You have to really think outside the box,
yep.
to find unique design solutions for studying something so literally outside our normal realm.
That's right. But there's a funny way in which it actually is easier. Working together in a virtual space is different from saying we work in different offices, so let's make you virtually present in my space. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the question of how you are actually seeing my space and how you're collecting the data about my space. In this case, the whole purpose of the rover is to collect this data about the environment. So we get to translate data we're already collecting and use that as the space that everyone is physically present in, virtually present in.
Now, is the team that worked on this project, by any chance, are any of you fans of the movie Disclosure? I believe it was from the late 90s with, God, what is that actor's name? Michael Douglas. It's a movie based on a Michael Crichton book. And there is this like ridiculous future file system that becomes a plot point towards the end of the movie. And they're all wandering around this rendered 3D environment that's supposed to be a file room in order to look at computer files, and like they encounter other users in the system. So it's like,
oh, that's wild.
The first example I can think of from, I guess you could call it science fiction, of that sort of environment being rendered so other people could collaborate within a place. But it's like late 90s rendering. So it's incredibly cheesy, like cheesy beyond
right.
belief.
Yeah. That's a really interesting example.
I recommend checking it out. It's so outdated and hilarious, but I think it fits in some way people's perception of how that stuff sort of works, to the point where even there was a recent episode of Community where they were making fun of the Oculus Rift and some other technologies.
Yeah.
But a lot of the visual cues from the episode are things I recognized from Disclosure, that they're very specific to that movie.
Yeah.
What a weird extreme form of skeuomorphism.
Yeah.
Like being like inside the digital filing cabinet. Like, there are better ways to visualize this.
Yeah,
idea.
Yeah. I mean, at the time, everybody was sitting there trying to figure that out and like, oh my God, this is the future. It's so cool.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we realized we didn't want that until it became time to explore Mars.
Right.
Right. That's right. Yeah. But it is interesting how you, the design challenges that come out of trying to overlay interface controls in a physical environment, even if it's a simulated physical environment. Because step one, it's like, oh, great, we have all the Mars data. We, you know, with a fair amount of computer science expertise, we can turn that into an explorable 3D environment. Okay, great. Now you need to choose which instrument you're planning for. Okay, now we need, you know, a menu or some other tool selection. And yeah. and there's this process of trying to figure out how we can make that work mm-hmm. in a physical environment that's already defined.
Yeah. yeah. And trying to represent physical objects that you cannot in fact touch. I mean, I don't know how deep this system goes and what exactly it's being used for, but I imagine that's got to be a fairly unique challenge.
Yeah, it's interesting, and certainly HoloLens is a brand new platform, mm-hmm. kind of in all senses of that, right? The other thing that happens is you say, okay, I think we're going to need a menu. Okay, great. How do menus work here? I don't know. You know, what are the perceptual issues? I don't know. Let's try some stuff. You know, how much can we fit on a screen and have it feel right?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Well, I mean, like the closest analog that we work with on a regular basis I can think of is the idea of trying to use a flat touchscreen monitor to manipulate something that's a representation of a physical object. Like for example, the flat screen monitors in cars, I think, are an abysmal problem that like you can get no tactile feedback from it whatsoever. But we're talking about two dimensions there, and like mm-hmm. when you start reaching into a third dimension of complexity there, how I think it would be such a fun problem to work on.
I think the other issue is, I mean, and this sounds like what you're getting at, Jesse, is that in most traditional computing environments that we're used to, there is a clear separation between the interface, you know, the computer world and the outside world. Mm-hmm. So you know that we have palettes and pop-ups and we have overlays for interface, but but it's clearly separated from where we are and where we're sitting. For here, if everything you're seeing is part of your computing environment, is part of your interface, the, you know, mm-hmm. Mars's landscape is being rolled around you, you know, there's no separation. You don't, it's sort of odd to like pull out a keyboard or pull out a mouse. And if you point, are you trying to point at the object that's rendered? Are you trying to point at something in real life? Do you do a little hand gesture that says, bring up a fake keyboard for me? Or do you start speaking, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a big part of what I'm talking about. And a lot of it you don't know until you try it. It's very difficult to prototype in any way other than code for this, because so much of it is about the perceptual experience you have with this device, with the environment. And then there are all these things you just don't think about. Like, okay, sure, we have menus. What happens if there's a rock in front of your menu? You know, that's not something I had to deal with before. And now we're like, oh, wow, we need to solve that. You know, like, that's a very real problem.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the other challenges that are really, truly unique to designing for space. We talked about the fact that you are extraordinarily distant from the place that you're studying. But that also introduces, I'm sure, tremendous time delay as well, both in how long it takes for Earth to communicate with the robotics out in the solar system, as well as the amount of planning and time it takes to build the robot, test the robot here, and then deploy it. And then it's flying around the solar system for 10 years before it gets anywhere. And so you're dealing with, you know, building technology to last for a long amount of time, for dealing with the harsh environment of space. It sounds just an entirely different world of problems.
Yeah, the time question comes up at a lot of different scales. I think probably the first time, a few months into my job here, we were talking about how to simulate real-time control when you actually have a time delay of you know, a high number of seconds or low number of minutes. And we got to the point in the discussion where we were saying, like, okay, so basically the problem is the speed of light, right? Like, that's our constraint. And I just burst out laughing because it was such a hilarious and ridiculous thing that, yes, that is, in fact, our design constraint.
Yeah.
So, like I said, this is an issue at a lot of different scales, right? If you're communicating with Mars, you have, you know, some minutes of time delay. I think it's like 4 to 22, depending on how the orbits are matching up. So that's enough that it means you can't drive a rover with a joystick, right? Mm-hmm. So there's that kind of problem. And we've looked at ways of doing that, of saying, well, you're most likely to be here in 10 minutes, but actually you could be anywhere in this range, so drive accordingly, right? If you stop and slow down, you can watch that sort of cone of uncertainty collapse.
So it's, instead of like direct control, it's more like predetermined algorithmic control, maybe. Like, this is what I want to do, and I can rely on the robotics in some way to handle the variance in situation that I'm not capable of accounting for due to my distance.
So that's actually another strategy, different from the one I just talked about.
Okay.
And that's one that they do use now for driving the rovers to some extent. Mm-hmm. You know, there's onboard logic and image processing that can let it self-correct based on the imagery it's seeing. So that's one technique. But the thing I didn't realize until I started working here is that even though you've got time delay from 4 to 22 minutes, the planning cycle for what the rover is actually doing is more on a daily cycle. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, has to do partially with the complexity of deciding what's next, and partially with the risk involved, right? Mm. So if you could just drive it with a joystick, you'd have to be unspeakably careful with it, right? So as to not damage the rover. So even though you have time delay, you're really working on daily planning cycles of saying, okay, what's the latest data? What do we want to do? How can we piece this plan together for the day so that we're okay in terms of power, in terms of data volume, that kind of thing? And then they'll uplink a full day's plan, which will run. And of course, they're onboard safety control. So if something goes wrong, the rover knows to stop and not injure itself. Mm-hmm. But you're really working at a daily level, which is interesting because it means that process and software are the ways to get faster. So we actually aren't hitting the speed of light problem for that kind of science operations yet. So luckily for me, that means the work that I'm doing actually has more impact. It means that if we can make tools to help scientists plan more efficiently and for the engineers to validate more efficiently, then we can get a better science return in the same amount of time.
Wow. So the scientists, your users are a highly specialized group. You are not designing an email app for, you know, 100 million people.
Yep.
What are the sorts of challenges and opportunities you have there? You know, I understand you're not trying to water something down so you can include lots of technical information, but of course, there's still people. You can't overwhelm them with way too much information.
Yep, exactly. I mean, one thing that people sometimes ask is they say, well, your users are really smart, right? They can deal with any software. And my answer, of course, is always, yeah, they're really smart. They have a really important job to do. We need to not waste their time with software that's confusing or misleading, much less something that could induce an error, which would obviously be catastrophic.
Yeah.
So the small group has some advantages and it has some challenges, right? One thing that's nice is a lot of these people work right here at JPL. If I need to test a sketch or interview someone or see how they work, I can walk 2 minutes down to another building and watch that happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge advantage. One of the challenges there is that there are a lot of techniques that do work for commercial scale websites that just can't happen here,
mm-hmm.
right? A/B testing is the thing I think about a lot, right? Amazon can say, oh, we'll just change the page for some percentage of users and see if the dollars go up and down, and then we'll do it again. There's no way for us to realistically do that. There are certain things that we can test in simulated circumstances, but even when we have that, we don't have the user volume to get statistical significance from that. So that's a technique that just cannot work here.
On the other hand, though, it sounds like, I mean, we typically try to avoid the situation where we interpret how to solve a design problem based on issues one user is having, but you have such a fairly small group of users that you can get consensus out of a small group of people. Like, you've got, I don't know, 5 to 10 people who are all saying, I really wish I could do that. That might actually be a great feature to put in there. Like, there's no second guessing.
Yeah, that can be true. It does depend a lot on the audience. A lot of times there's sort of a long tail of users. Mm-hmm. So for Curiosity in particular, there are 500 members of the science mm-hmm. team, and they're distributed all over the world. But there are probably only maybe 100 who are involved on a regular basis, and there are only, you know, a handful that are here doing their work at JPL all the time. Mm-hmm. So you kind of see different flavors of this. The other flip side is that if you are developing software for 10 people, you clearly don't have the budget for design and development that you do if you're designing an email application for the world, right?
Okay, that's a constraint I hadn't considered.
Yeah, so in general that balances, but we still have hard decisions to make about what features go in and what doesn't go in. But that's as much also just about keeping a product clear and cohesive, right? Mm-hmm. Regardless of the size of your user pool, you never just want to build everything that they suggest. Mm-hmm. You know, at the very least, you want to make sure that you're understanding the need that they're expressing. Because mm-hmm. a lot of times, as I'm sure you guys know, people will say, oh, I need this feature. And while that feature might be one solution to their problem, it might not be the best solution for their problem.
Yeah, what they really mean is I need to accomplish this thing.
Exactly.
Get that sorted out.
Exactly. So yeah, we have the advantage of being able to have that conversation with exactly the user population that we're serving. So we aren't trying to extrapolate that. We can say, oh, you say you need this tool. Tell me about how you do your work now. Tell me about what's missing. And we can then, you know, come up with a solution that makes sense.
Are there limitations that you face from the technology on the robotics themselves? You know, we talked about how you launch a rocket into space and the rover takes however many months or years to get where it's going to be. And so there's, you know, let's say by the time it lands, it's 3-year-old technology. But I know from what I've read that technology is actually significantly older on top of that, too, from the long speccing process and making sure that it's safe for travel and that it's reliable. So you might be dealing with what's essentially 10-year-old hardware.
Yep.
Are you running into limitations on what it can do by the time it's out there?
There certainly are limitations. You know, I think 10 years is about right for the lead time for, you know, something like a CPU that's going to be on there. It's definitely an issue. There's, to some extent, you can tune that a little bit based on how much you're willing to spend, right? You can say, we're going to shell out for a camera or a CPU that's incredibly advanced now. But yeah, typically we're looking at things that are about 10 years old. And really what happens most of the time there is any shortcomings we have on the rover hardware, we have to balance in ground software or hardware, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like these things are fully autonomous. And we can also, of course, update the software on the rover, although that is very risky.
Sure.
But we do that fairly regularly. So there are constraints there. It's interesting. I feel like while that's a constraint, from my point of view, it's not necessarily a frustrating constraint. It's, I think, one of the more publicly visible things. You know, it's easy to say like, oh, well, my phone can do more than whatever. And that's all true. But I don't know. There's an aspect of that. I think it's people accept that that's the way it is. There have to be long lead times. There's no shortcut for that.
Yeah.
But it does mean that we want to squeeze all the capability that we do have out of that hardware. We want to make sure that any autonomy we can run there, we're taking advantage of, and that, you know, the processes on Earth and the software on Earth is sophisticated enough to really maximize what we have.
Yeah, I mean, advances, we've come so far in a matter of decades anyways. I mean, you look at the original Apollo program, and people say that the modules actually had less computing power than a TI-83.
Yep.
I mean, if we can land on the moon with that, at least we know we've got like some robust, good quality hardware and software we can send out there. Even if it creates some physical limitations,
mm-hmm.
we're still capable of sending something to Mars. That's
yep.
so amazing.
Yeah. And I think these kinds of limitations breed creativity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a designer, we often talk about how much we love a limited palette or whatever the limitation may be that might seem small in the grand scheme of things, but it's not something where you feel like, boy, my hands are tied. I could do something better if I could use more colors, because that's not the answer. It's not, you know, I could do more and be better if I had some magical future space robot. It's this is the reality of the situation. This is a limitation, and it forces me to have to think creatively to find a way to get the most out of this hardware, this software, this limitation in the speed of light.
Yeah.
I'm never going to get to say, well, we can't do this because physics.
Right.
That's probably not going to happen in my job.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. But I think the other reason that it isn't more frustrating than it is there's an outlet for that, and it's the next mission.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So Mars 2020 is coming up, and it's basically the same setup as MSL, as Curiosity, but with better instruments. Right. So there are people now who've said, okay, here's the next generation of these instruments. We're going to do it better next time, you know? And so, yeah, we're working on this one now. And by the way, we're still running Opportunity, you know, more than 10 years later. I mean, if you want to talk about hardware limitations, you know, that was designed, what, 20 years ago. And we're still getting useful science data back from that. And everything feeds into the next thing.
That's great. I mean, the future sounds rich and ripe with possibility. What else can we look forward to? And as NASA JPL paves the actual future, not just the science fiction future.
Well, I think the immersive planning stuff is really exciting, and we certainly hope that will continue. The future Mars missions are a possibility for that. There are other possibilities for that. Our group works on a wide range of problems, so not just the Mars missions, but we're looking at, well, I mentioned this kind of simulated real-time control. We work on 3D control applications for other robots like Athlete, which is this totally amazing hexapod robot. And we also work on other pieces of the problem. Like, we're working on some new interfaces for controllers at the Deep Space Network, which we didn't even get into, but that's how we actually talk to all these spacecraft. Mm. You know, there's this communication network of huge satellites, and there are all kinds of interesting issues around making sure that that's operating properly and that the operators can solve problems quickly and all of that. So that's a huge push as well. And like I said, I think this intersection of 3D gaming hardware and science work is at a really interesting moment now. I mean, that's just going to explode. I think the HoloLens is the first of many of that class of device. And we're really looking forward to using all the new stuff in whichever way it makes sense.
Well, we are just waiting with bated breath and excited to see what the future holds. No surprise, we're all a bunch of tech nerds here, and that has a decent overlap of people who are space nerds and, you know, love seeing the news about Europa, the Europa Clipper mission, the Asteroid Hunter. Just all of a sudden, it seems like our solar system is just full of water everywhere, and it's just really exciting yeah. time to...
The fact that people are working on, like, practical implementations of an ion engine. I just hope it sounds like a TIE fighter. That's all I really care about.
Yeah. So we'll be excited to watch your team and see what's coming out.
Great.
So Jesse, thank you so much for coming on the show today. If folks want to get a hold of you or learn more about what you're working on, where can they find you?
Twitter is a good way to go. I'm jkriss on Twitter. It's jkriss. And you can also see some stuff at my website, which is jklabs.net. But you can also search for me on the internet and find me other places.
Will do. Everybody, make sure you do that. You can find us on Twitter at The Dirt Show. If you've got something that you can't quite fit into the voluminous 140 characters Twitter allows, send us an email at thedirt@freshtilledsoil.com. If you like today's show, recommend us to a friend. We'd really like that.
Or review us
on iTunes. From what we understand of the mysterious algorithm, it does help us get introduced to more people. So shoot us a review. That'd be great. That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening, and we will try and do better next time.
Oh my God. The leading U.S. Center for Robotic Exploration of the Solar System. Holy shit. This is going to be a great episode. Like, fucking holograms, man. Dude, we're interviewing someone from NASA. Mark, we're interviewing somebody from NASA. I hope he looks like Ed Harris from Apollo 13. Vest and everything.
He doesn't.
But I hope he does.
He doesn't look like Ed Harris in general.
If we get NASA to tweet about the show, I'm going to rub it in my brother's face for the rest of his life. Talking to NASA, we're talking to NASA. That was fucking awesome.
It's pretty cool.
I forgot to ask him if the moon landing was real or not.